You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 28th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, fellow with Type Investigations, Sarah Posner, on her book Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Also on the program today, the Republicans in the Senate announce its stimulus package, and it is twisted. Meanwhile, Bill Barr, sitting in a Congressional Judiciary Committee hearing as we speak, defiantly, I should say, Texas COVID deaths spike as they finally start counting all of them. Democrats lead in Senate swing state races across the country. And Andrew Cuomo does a solid for Senate Republicans by writing word for word their corporate immunity law. In Georgia, David Perdue successfully puts John Ossoff's Judaism in play. More federal police sent to Portland. And the Democratic Party platform rejects Medicare for All and pot legalization because. And after less than a week of baseball, 11 members of the 40-man roster Marlins are infected with COVID. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Matt is back with us today. You know, I said this yesterday, and this will probably be the last day I start off the show this way, but things are going to be weird for a while, and we're going to work through it. I imagine we're still going to hear plenty from folks who want to remember Michael when they call into the show, and that's okay. It's just going to take some time. We are moving ahead with our plans on Thursdays, at least for the month of August. Starting with this Thursday, we're going to play some interviews from Michael Thursdays, and maybe Matt and Michael Mondays in the first half of the program, and then we'll do we'll have a fun half that will be more current, and we're going to try that for a month or so, just to remind folks of some of the stuff that maybe they missed. Have you recently joined or whatnot? That will be a fun and probably a little sad for folks. That's what we're going to do with it. And, you know, we will get to a point where things are, you know, feel not so weird. But that's going to take time. And so that's the way we're going to do it. We don't really have any other choice, frankly. It is the cards we've been dealt, and that's what we got to play. So that's what we will do on the program. Thank you for being here. And again, thank you for all the notes, and thank you. We've had people email in with suggestions as to what we should play on those Thursdays. If you want to, if there is an interview that you particularly remember that Michael did on a Thursday or a Monday, or you know, maybe a random other day, but on this show, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and just put in the subject line for Michael, and we will go through those. And like I say, we're going to be playing them on Thursdays. at least for the next month or so. And that's that. We have some other things that we're, you know, working on, but we're all, you know, just sort of like, trying to work our way back to functioning better. So that's what we'll do. In the meantime, we've got a clip. I don't have my sound sheet for me. I gotta get my kid to bring it in if I can get them to. But you'll recall that I guess this was 2 years ago now at Politicon. Year and a half, I don't remember. I had the opportunity to debate Charlie Kirk. And there's been an interesting story that's out by ProPublica about Turning Points USA and some discrepancies or some questions that people have about their tax status and about the how much money Charlie Kirk is getting paid. And maybe I'll save that for tomorrow because it's a funny story because that came up right before our debate, actually. But Charlie Kirk is a guy who's been running this organization that ostensibly is for college students. But really, what it's one of those things where it's for old people who are on the right and want to think that they're influencing college students.
Whose grandkids are in college.
Whose grandkids might be in college. And probably they're mad. Like, you know, Jenny came home and was talking about Black Lives Mattering. You know, that type of thing. Where can I put money in?
Black Lives Matter counterpoint.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the way the guy has made a considerable amount of money and made big inroads. He's very close with Donald Trump and the Trump crew of people. And here is Charlie Kirk. Now, I don't know. Does he have a show that is on? Is that what it's called? The Charlie Kirk Show?
That's what it looks like.
I guess he's rolling that out.
New to me.
Okay. And
you gotta come in, you know, first episode, you got to come in with the top of your game.
Exactly.
Roll out and everything.
Exactly. And I have my sound sheet here. My assistant brought it in. Actually, I don't have it. No, I hadn't printed it out yet. So let's get to that. This is a clip from the Charlie Kirk Show.
Do not force me to wear a mask. It's that simple. I'm not going to do it. I'm not. The only time I comply is on the airlines because I actually need to fly the airlines to be able to do my job and travel the country so I can deliver truth to you and make an income and grow Turning Point USA. So that's the fight I do not fight. But every single time I go into one of these grocery stores, where's your mask? I say, well, first of all, the science around masks is very questionable. Very questionable. In fact, some people, some doctors think that masks actually make you sicker and have you less likely to be able to get oxygen and more likely to infect yourself and less likely to be able to fight the virus and actually more likely.
Pause it. Let me just make something absolutely clear. There is no reputable doctor in the country who believes that wearing a mask makes you more likely to get infected. There was early on when the medical community thought that the primary way one gets infected is by touching an infected area and going to your face. And there was some concern that people would be fidgeting with their masks. There is no reputable doctor, researcher, in the country, maybe in the world, who believes that masks undercut your ability to get oxygen. That's absurd. All you need to do is watch a fictional television show, and you will see all of these doctors when they go into surgery and they're wearing masks. And why are they wearing masks? Because they don't want the stuff inside them to get inside the body. They don't want their germs to be projected out. And again, I'll remind you, this notion, like you see these people with taking a CO2 meter and putting it in their mask and going, look at the CO2 reading. The difference in size between a molecule of CO2 or a molecule of the coronavirus is like the equivalent to a, I don't know, this may be actually even understating it, a golf ball to a massive beach ball. CO2 will go through the fibers of any mask that you're wearing, unless it's a plastic bag over your head. Whereas the coronavirus, much less likely to make it through because it's much, much larger. I think we got some response last time. I think it's like 1,000 times bigger. Still very tiny to the naked eye. But let's just roll that out there. But go ahead.
Oxygen and more likely to infect yourself and less likely to be able to fight the virus and actually more likely to be able to die sooner. A lot of people believe that. I've met many doctors that hold that view. Secondly, we have a huge civil liberty issue here. Why do you have the authority to tell me what I can and cannot do with my body? I thought it was my body, my choice. I thought that was the entire thought process as to why we are wrongly able to terminate a million children in the womb every single year.
Pause.
And so I just don't like being told.
Let's see. What? And maybe I've missed in the video. Maybe Charlie's put it out there. But no shoes, no shirt, no service in a restaurant. I mean, are we really? Is he really going to complain about that as well? Why do you get the? There's a big difference between the government telling you what to do and a business telling you what to do. A. Now, it is the case that in public, in some areas where there is a mandatory mask requirement, but there is a large body of, and it has been supported by the Supreme Court, actually, even in the context of religious organizations. We have a concept in this country that rights can be abridged if there is a compelling government reason to do so. And the government has found that it's a compelling reason to do so because it's in the name of public safety. It's a little bit different. There is no public safety questions when it comes to the right of a woman to get an abortion. But continue.
Only able to terminate a million children in the womb every single year. And so I just don't like being told what to do generally by the federal government. I'm not a type of person who plays well when the government comes in and starts to say you must put this on your face. Now, I think there's some restrictions that I support. I'm actually in the minority.
Pause
I support seatbelt laws.
Pause it 1 second. There is no federal mandate, incidentally, to wear a mask. There's never been a question of one. We would like one, maybe, but there isn't one at all. Not at all. And in fact, if he has a problem with the federal government doing it, then it would make sense that he would have no problem if the city did it, in which case he'd have a problem with the states that have denied cities the opportunity, like in Georgia, to require face masks. But go.
I'm actually in the minority. I support seatbelt laws because I think seatbelts actually save lives.
Reasonable.
And I actually think it's not that big of an infringement on your liberty. I kind of disagree with a lot of people on this. I mean, some super strict libertarians say, oh, no, seatbelts ever. Okay. If you fly through the window of a car because you didn't want to wear a seatbelt, and all of a sudden I have to pay for your health care, that's ridiculous. A mask might not even work. A mask is questionable at best. So the science around masks needs to be debated more. And the fact that these Republican governors are like, oh, you must wear a mask, I think it's nonsense. And I don't think it's popular. I have never met anyone that says, I just love wearing my mask. I love it. Yeah, I mean, okay. I am not a fan. I think it's dehumanizing. When I see a 4-year-old wearing a mask, I can't think but help. We have let them down, and we have robbed them of their childhood.
Well, I mean, in a way.
Yes. Yes, by making sure that their parents don't die. So let me get this straight. What about the concept of you get COVID and our healthcare system has to pay for it? We have 100 and nearly 50,000 dead. I don't even know how many more have been hospitalized for extended periods of time than that. Is it a measure of 4 times, 5 times that more? It's the exact same dynamic. It's the exact same dynamic, except there is actually more of an argument that your inhibition or your refusal to wear a mask harms other people in the community more than you not wearing your seatbelt. There's a far more compelling argument that the state needs to step in and tell you to wear a mask. And the idea that there is any, even a shred of science that says wearing a mask makes it more likely you will catch COVID or is more dangerous is absurd.
I did some research on the Charlie Kirk Show. So it's been around as a podcast since last summer, at least. But they recently did a pivot to video about a month ago. So I would just welcome, they got about 75,000 followers. I would just welcome, I would just encourage our watchers to go welcome him to YouTube.
Absolutely. And here's the question I want to know. Now that we're seeing him in all his glory, why is his hair so long? I mean, why isn't he getting a haircut? The dude would go on an airplane without a mask if they would let him. Why doesn't he go get a haircut somewhere? He's so full of crap, it's unbelievable. And that's the beauty of what he's doing there. You can sort of like start to see the scenes a little bit. Like, I want to show you that I am not in bed with the Republicans. I think it's ridiculous that there are some Republican governors calling for masks. And yes, I think I'd say the one accurate thing is that I've yet to meet somebody who says, I love my mask.
Yeah. Also, it's funny to go back and look when he was a Ted Cruz fan in the 2016 Republican primary and was really aghast at some of Donald Trump's antics, and look at where he is now, kind of the reverse maturity.
I'll tell you where he is now. He is making apparently at least $300,000 a year. That's where he is now.
That's
not bad as a 26-year-old. That's pretty good.
Pretty good.
He looks older than that, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's I think that's what's behind the hair. He's trying to keep his youthful, buoyance.
That's very possible. It's very possible. It also could be possible that he's actually genuinely afraid of getting COVID. And the one place he would be seen in public would be on an airline. And he knows he's got to make up an excuse for why he's wearing it, because he's got to be. He's not a total idiot.
Because if he gets COVID, we'll do a video about it.
If he gets COVID, we will do a video about it.
Yeah.
I've got an interesting piece here of. But I will get to that later, of a guy who had a very similar idea about COVID as Charlie Kirk. But we'll get to that soon. I mentioned it's going to be weird when we do ads a little bit in this with everything that's been going on. But the reality is, this morning for breakfast, I had some Magic Spoon. I didn't realize that we'd be reading an ad from them today, but this episode brought to you by Magic Spoon. As you recall, breakfast cereal, one of the best parts of being a kid. Why? Because in some instances, maybe your folks didn't spend a lot of time making breakfast, so they weren't so good at it. But also, who doesn't want like a bowl of like sweet chocolatey goodness in the morning? As an adult, you realize, I'm not going to feed my kids cereals like that. I'm not going to eat cereals like that. It's full of sugar, full of junk. Magic Spoon is a new cereal company that's discovered a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals with, you ready for this? Zero sugar. And with 11 grams of protein, only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. Magic Spoon offers 4 flavors based on all-time classics, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry, plus a variety pack that lets you try them all. They've recreated the taste and the texture of classic sugary cereal, but it tastes so incredible, you'd never guess it was healthy. It's keto-friendly, it's gluten-free, it's grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, GMO-free. My kids love this stuff. My favorite flavor of these 4, I'm not supposed to say anything about the other ones, but I gotta say, I like the other ones too. My favorite of these 4 is the chocolate, cocoa. It's delicious. My kids love the fruity. They love the frosted. And we mix it in with the blueberry every now and then for a change up. But they're delicious. And you eat it and you realize, like, I'm not eating the same junk that it tastes like I'm eating. It's delicious. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Grab a variety pack. Try it today. Use the promo code majorityreport at checkout. You get free shipping. Magic Spoon's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Code Majority Report for free shipping. I had some this very morning. I kid you not. All right, can I take a quick break? When we come back, we'll be talking to a fellow with the type with Type Investigations, Sarah Posner, on her book, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. And I should say, Charlie Kirk, one of those guys. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome, I believe, back to the program. I mean, I know that we've talked right in the past many times, I have a feeling. Reporting fellow with Type Investigations and author of Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Sarah Posner, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sam.
I feel like, right now, I can't remember anything, but I know we had you on for your last book, I believe, and also countless stories over the years. And you have been reporting on evangelicals and the Christian and Christian movement, I guess, in this country for, I think, like 15 years. I mean, as long as I can remember.
A long time.
And let's just start with this. When we say Christian, when we say, you know, white evangelicals, who are we talking about? Like, what, like, give us a sense of who these people are, because I think your reporting, certainly over the past couple of years, has exposed that they're not necessarily who we would think they are, at least in terms of the way that they practice their lives. Let's put it that way.
White evangelicals make up a big chunk of the Republican Party base, and they are also a crucial part of the what's known as the religious right or the Christian right, which is also an alliance with right-wing Catholics and conservative mainline Protestants. But white evangelicals are the driving force of the religious right and of Trump's presidency. And so this is people who largely attend evangelical churches, Pentecostal churches, charismatic churches. These might be churches that are affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention or a non-denominational church that practices faith healing, or a non-denominational church that promotes the prosperity gospel. So it's not one single theological unit, but they share a common theological belief that They're born again in Jesus Christ, and they have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And more than any other religious demographic, they're very politically homogenous. 81% of them voted for Donald Trump in 2016.
How often do they go to church? I mean, how pious? I mean, you know, I identify as a Jew, but I don't. But there's a huge difference in my worldview than, let's say, maybe who a Jew who lives in a Hasidic community, you know, in a different part of Brooklyn. How pious, how practicing are they? They belong to these churches. I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, because I think I saw one study back where folks would identify as being evangelical Christians, but then also say, like, I don't really go to church, though.
Right. I think the thing that's important to understand is that churches obviously play a really important role in evangelicals' lives. But in terms of their political identity or their political ideology, it's way more than church, right? So there's church where they might go once a week or maybe even less often. But then maybe there's also the Wednesday night Bible study or the televangelist that they like watching on TV or conferences that they like to go to, the newsletters they get from the Family Research Council or the Faith and Freedom Coalition or any number of political groups or the Facebook pages that they subscribe to. So it's not just church itself, but it's a wider cultural and political community that reinforces a lot of the political beliefs and ideology. And in the Trump era, conspiracy theories and, you know, claims about who Trump is and who Trump's enemies are, for example.
Right. And I want to get into that, but we need to understand white evangelicals as as much as a cultural group as it is a religious group in that sense, right? I mean, it's a culture that is built around a religion, but it is a culture in the sense that they're getting their media, their music, their how-tos on raising kids and their education. All of these things are, they're all sort of like, they're all culturally consistent.
Right. And culturally connected. So you could go to a conference where you would meet people from all over the country who might be familiar with each other's pastors or each other's quote unquote teachers, because they have a very robust media ecosystem where various teachers or pastors are broadcast all over the country. So you're not just learning from or getting cultural or theological reinforcement from your own pastor, but it's a wider circle of ideas and media and ideology.
Is it safe to say that Donald Trump was not immersed in this culture at any point in his life?
Well, he was immersed in a certain aspect of this culture, which is very important to their political organizing, and that is televangelism. So the story about Trump goes that, you know, he went to Norman Vincent Peale's church when he was a kid. Of course, Norman Vincent Peale is famous for the power of positive thinking, but probably more importantly for Trump's political organizing, he became interested in the televangelist Paula White in the early to mid 2000s. And the story that Trump's friends and allies like to tell is that he likes to channel surf. He likes to channel surf to Christian television. And he saw Paula White on her television show, and he wanted to meet her, and he had his secretary call her up, and he brought her to Trump Tower, and they've been friends ever since. And she's now considered to be his top spiritual advisor, and she even has an official advisor role in the White House to his faith-based initiative. So he was not necessarily immersed in going to church, but he was very immersed in this prosperity gospel culture where they teach that God wants you to be rich, and a sign of God's blessing is that you are rich. God wants you to be healthy, but only those who have faith in God are going to be healthy and have the ability to heal themselves or experience miraculous healing or miraculous riches. And so to the extent that he was immersed in that world, that was what first connected him to the Christian right.
Do we have a sense of what it was about when he's watching, like, you know, what's he looking for when he's doing that? I mean, he's doing, you know, like, I imagine he had political aspirations back then, but I don't know. Right. Do you think that's what he was doing, or was it just like he was looking at this like, this could be a potential business for me, or maybe he wants to learn how do you do like direct marketing? I mean, what?
It's hard to tell. The way the story was conveyed to me by Johnny Moore, who's also one of Trump's religious advisors, evangelical advisors, was that Trump was just channel surfing and he happened on Paula White, and she was giving a sermon on what was called, the title of it was The Value of Vision, and that it had a lot to do with being able to have a vision for your business life or your business success. And this is what appealed to him as a businessman, that there was some connection between believing in the Bible or something you could find in the Bible and having a successful business. He may have had other motivations as well that I don't know about them, but that was the way the story was conveyed to me.
Fair enough. He has at least a sense of like of what's going on and on some of the communications wing of this. So how does he go? he is considered by some of these folks, and I mean, largely this is a story of hypocrisy, but I'm not 100% sure if that's the case. I get the transactional stuff and we'll get to that. Right. I mean, that to me, it makes total sense, but there are people in this community who it appears genuinely believe that he is chosen by God to deliver for them. And will you go into that and the sort of like the idea of, and I guess maybe this speaks to sort of like what some people would call an authoritarianism streak within, religious followers, but the idea of a strong man.
Right. So the Christian right believes that God intended for America to be founded America, played a role in founding America as a Christian nation, and that America's Christian heritage has been under attack by secularism, by feminism, by social justice warriors, by political correctness, by socialism.
Me.
Right? So like they have I'm sorry?
Me.
By you.
And folks like me. Yes.
and so the through line of my book, you know, which is about how the Christian right came to mobilize around Donald Trump alongside the alt-right, and that a lot of this had to do with race as well as religion, right? But a through line of the book is that they don't like a liberal democracy. They don't like a pluralistic secular democracy. And so Trump comes along and he is willing to cast aspersions on all of their bogeyman that they've been developing over the past several decades. He's willing to claim on their behalf that their religious freedom is under siege, and he's going to save their religious freedom from all of these terrible forces that are infringing on it. And so even though Trump doesn't have any particular history with opposing abortion or even opposing LGBTQ rights before he starts running for president, they come to accept him and embrace him as this savior who is going to use illiberal or undemocratic means to achieve their vision for America that they think has been lost to all of these terrible liberal forces.
And what amazes me that you write about in this is that there's this real sense that they who come to that conclusion are the congregants, right? Like that largely the leadership of white evangelicals across the board, they were sort of following their congregations.
So there were a few people, well-known people who got on board early with Trump. People will probably remember Robert Jeffress. Well, Paula White, obviously, because she had been on board with him for a while. Robert Jeffress, who's now one of his top religious advisors. He's a megachurch pastor from Dallas. He endorsed Trump fairly early. And then there was a lot of attention on Jerry Falwell Jr., who endorsed Trump very right before the primaries got underway. But largely the leadership was headed towards somebody like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or even Ben Carson. But what they found was the grassroots was loving Trump, and Trump in this crowded field of people with a lot of evangelical cred, like Cruz and Rubio and Scott Walker and a host of other people in that huge field. Trump was getting a plurality of evangelical support, according to polling. And so once it became obvious that Trump was just steamrolling over these other candidates and that the grassroots was really mobilized behind him, more of the leadership started to fall into line.
All right. So let's talk about what the mechanics. Let's get to, I guess, like the grievances that you write about that bind these folks. I mean, I'm trying to get to, like, you know, what it is about Trump that that the congregation responded to, right? I mean, they're not the ones who are going to be convinced or are sitting in a room where Trump is, you know, transactionally saying, like, look, this is what I'm going to deliver for you. I don't know if it's going to be a wad of cash or whatever it is, but or just, you know, religious freedom, executive orders or whatever it is. What is it that binds these folks? Like, what was it that Trump was saying that was basically making white evangelicals feel like this is a guy who may not have walked the walk, but he is going to protect our interests? I mean, what were those interests?
So they, well, first of all, abortion has become a top issue for them. And so you're right, to a certain extent, this was transactional. He promised judges or Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe versus Wade. That was a big deal.
But every Republican does. I mean, more or less, right? Maybe he does it a little bit more explicitly, but they all more or less do that.
Right. So, but that's an important deal sealer. But I think more crucially for the base was Trump's way of speaking, right? His way of articulating grievances about, I mean, when you think about the early stages of his campaign, when he was running in the primary, he had grievances about Black Lives Matter. He had grievances about immigrants. He had grievances about political correctness in general, or globalists, or just this litany of what is perceived by the base to be liberal ideas or scapegoats that they have come to believe has changed that Christian America that they believe God intended the country to be. And so they see Trump as coming in and just being what some of them call a wrecking ball or a disruptor, and that he's unafraid to just smash it all to bits so that there can be this revitalization of the Christian America that God intended. And so a lot of this has to do with their perception of, say, church-state separation as an infringement of their religious freedom, or marriage equality as necessarily an infringement of their religious freedom. So to the extent that civil rights for other people are seen as a, you know, there's like a, to them, a push-pull or an equal and opposite reaction, where those rights necessarily mean an infringement of their rights as Christians. Trump was articulating that in a way that didn't soft pedal it at all, didn't bend to what they thought was political correctness or bipartisanship. And that was very appealing to have this staunch warrior on their behalf.
To what extent have we seen a change in the numbers of the people that voted for Trump? In other words, like, I'm trying to get a sense of how much of, you know, one of the narratives that we hear. Now, obviously, this cohort, white evangelicals, were key to Trump's victory, it seems to me. Like, he's not able to mobilize these people. Forget it. You can't run as a Republican unless they're going to support you.
Right.
To what extent, like, how large has that demographic, that cohort, where is that in terms of its growth trajectory, A? And B, and I ask that because one of the narratives that came out of his election was that we are having, you know, the life expectancy of white males dropped around that time. As a function largely of the opioid problem, but it also was, you know, sort of coexisting with a drop in wages and real wages, and small towns and rural areas in particular, and older cities being, you know, depleted. And I mean, I wonder, like, you know, where does material the material experience of these people come into this? Has their numbers changed as situations have gotten worse for people, like economically and whatnot? Or, you know, where does that play into it? Or was that completely irrelevant in the context? Are they just their voting cues, the things that motivate them, are just completely divorced from that material world?
I think for the most part, yes, they are. But I think the demographic changes that are happening, which are resulting in white evangelicals being a smaller part of the U.S. population overall, has to do with younger people, the 18 to 29 year olds or the 18 to 40 year olds being less white and also less religious, right? So that has diminished the percentage of white evangelicals vis-a-vis the rest of the population. However, the really important thing to remember in terms of elections is that they make up about 25% of the electorate, right? So they vote in, they're very robust voters, and that's in part because of the culture that we talked about at the top, where the church and the televangelist and the political organizations reinforce each other with very robust and effective get out the vote operations. And they make up about, you know, a third of the Republican electorate. So Trump knows this, where, you know, the people around Trump know this, and the religious right political organizations on the ground are working very hard as we speak to mobilize white evangelicals and white conservative Catholics and other Christians to the polls in support of Trump, because of his base, right? They're the sort of most consistent voters and have the most organized get out the vote machinery.
Let's talk about the politicization of these folks and the grounds on which they were politicized. There's the story of, I think it was Weyrich meeting with religious leaders in the mid to late 70s as they're trying to figure out, like, what topic can we use? What issue can we use to mobilize folks? And you have it was abortion, supposedly. You have an amendment to that story, or maybe a revision slightly.
So Paul Weyrich was one of the main architects of the religious right. He came to Washington in the late 1960s. He helped build this movement called the New Right, which, you know, it was new at the time, right? And he was trying to organize a coalition of conservatives who rejected what you might sort of shorthandedly call country club conservatism or country club republicanism. And as part of that, he believed that he really needed to bring in religious voters, that they were going to be a really important part of this kind of middle America white coalition of voters that was going to remake the Republican Party. And he was a very right-wing Catholic, and so he had all along been opposed to abortion, but he could not get these evangelicals and fundamentalists that he was working with excited about the abortion issue in the 1970s. This is in the lead up to the formation of the Moral Majority in 1979. But by Weyrich's own admission and by the historical record, the evangelicals and fundamentalists who got involved with forming the Moral Majority were animated by something else entirely. And that was the federal government's effort to desegregate private and private Christian schools in the wake of the school desegregation of public schools that happened after Brown v. Board of Education. And so this idea that the government was infringing on the religious rights of these Christian schools by demanding, according to them, quote unquote, quotas of Black students that needed to go to their Christian schools, that was a great infringement of their religious liberty. And this formed the basis for a lot of the political organizing, even to this day, for the Christian right, where you'll see them invoking Bob Jones University, which was the big, the most well-known of these cases, where Bob Jones University, a fundamentalist college in South Carolina, had its tax exemption revoked because of its racist policies. It had a policy against interracial dating on campus. And it was a Supreme Court case. I mean, they claimed that this was a great violation of their religious freedom. So what you see today, even today, religious right activists will claim that, oh, the IRS is going to take away the tax exemption of churches or nonprofit organizations that oppose same-sex marriage. And so this kind of idea that the government is the enemy of the religious freedom of these Christians pervades the religious right decades later. But the reality is that it was these racial grievances, not abortion, that initially got these activists involved in the Moral Majority and the other organizations that formed at that time. And it was only later that abortion, that they sort of got on board with the abortion issue, and that later became their top organizing issue.
There's two things that strike me. One is that there is a sense now, and we just saw Josh Hawley come out with a big litmus test for abortion, that abortion is not just a litmus test for abortion. It is that if you are all in on, as a judge, on limiting the right of a woman to get an abortion, then there is a sense amongst those folks that you line up straight down the line on every other issue that is super important. And so abortion becomes sort of like a talisman on some level. Mm-hmm. If you cross that threshold, everything else lines up perfectly. And you don't even have to ask about, you know, where they are on corporate rights or where they are on the rights of let's say, you know, accused criminals or where they are on a whole host of other issues that are completely unrelated. But that if you line up a hardcore anti-abortion, you're going to be okay on all the other things down the line, at least in the judicial level. And then the other thing that strikes me as you say that is that construction of infringement of religious freedom, where it's, we're not going to give you tax, we're not going to give you tax free status, which is really like, you know, we're just not going to give you this special privilege. That construction is more in play in this era than I think at any other time in between, it seems to me.
Well, it's interesting because it's the right that has made the question of, oh, my tax dollars are funding abortion or my tax dollars are funding contraception. They've really made that such a key issue for them. The idea that there might be some, there might be some penny or dollar somewhere in Obamacare that's using taxpayer funding for abortion. Yet their complaint about the government enforcement of what is not only stated government policy, but the law, you know, on civil rights and school desegregation and LGBT rights and same-sex marriage, that they think it's okay for the taxpayers to basically be subsidizing their nonprofit organizations despite their opposition to these civil rights for other people. And the other thing that's kind of crazy about all of that is that the IRS has not done this, right? Like nobody has gotten their tax exemption taken away for any of these reasons. And certainly no church has had their tax exempt status taken away because of their opposition to same-sex marriage. So, but yes, I mean, abortion becomes the top litmus test issue, but it's connected with all of these notions about what is their religious freedom and what is the role of the government in enforcing rights for other people when it comes up against what they claim is their religious rights.
To what extent is Mike Pence, what role does he play in this one? Because I've been told that by one of his biographers that Mike Pence is the most powerful is the most powerful theocrat that we have had in this country's history, as he sits as a vice president, as a sitting vice president. Is that your sense, A, and B, like, what is Mike Pence doing this work? I mean, is he the one, because you talk about Health and Human Services as being a very important, you know, sort of a center for a lot of these folks, but you can also see them like Betsy DeVos and sure, Mike Pompeo and just about every other
Bill Barr.
I mean, I don't think people fully realize how religious this administration is. Is Mike Pence the guy who's basically saying, like, this guy hits, you know, both your list, Donald Trump, which is he's loyal and, you know, and he's willing to, you know, maybe be, you know, cut a couple corners. And also the religious right, because this guy's dyed in the wool. I mean, what is Pence doing in that administration?
So I think that Pence initially was picked because he had so much cred with the religious right. I mean, dating back to the time before he was a congressman, he had a radio show in Indiana. He was a very respected, admired congressman for the Christian right when he served in Congress and later as governor of Indiana. And so I think originally I thought that he was just going to be like the bridge or the person who gave Trump the imprimatur for the base. But as I've watched him interact with Trump and interact with the base over the course of Trump's presidency, and watching how the Christian right really went to bat for Trump during impeachment, when you might have thought, well, so what if Trump were to get impeached? Because they would have Pence, and Pence is willing to do all of the policy things that Trump is willing to do for them. So what gives here? And I really think that Pence sort of models for them what it's like to submit to Trump. I know that sounds a little bit terrifying and wild, but
super creepy.
If you watch him, he's very submissive to Trump, and submission to authority, especially divine authority, is very important in this culture. And I think that the role that he's played, especially in the later years of Trump's presidency, has been to show how you are submissive to Trump.
I'm sorry. It's just like so creepy to me, that dynamic. And it really, I'm thinking about those like Dear Leader round tables they have where they sit around a conference room,
right,
and everybody
exactly
goes, is like, you are, it's, it, I mean, it is, it's like this, they're paying tribute, right? I mean, it's, you know, one of them is going to bring their firstborn son and slay them on the table right in front of them, I guess.
I think that it's really important to understand that submission to authority and what is perceived as godly authority is playing a role here in terms of how Pence and other members of Trump's cabinet, who may say negative or disparaging things about him in private that, you know, White House reporters get wind of off the record, right? But in public, they're extremely dutiful and submissive to him. And I think that's their reading of the base's view of Trump as this kind of authority or savior figure.
So when we get stuff like Trump is, you know, the comparing, there's a Trump Cyrus the Great coin, which you can buy online. Mm-hmm. Like, are those... Who's developing those and putting them out? I'm not saying specifically the coin, although I'd be curious about that. But I mean, who's like, are these developments of these comparisons like serving a similar function as Mike Pence sort of modeling to everybody on, you know, how he is compliant with the alpha?
Well, I think with the Cyrus comparison, that is intended to deflect the argument that Trump isn't a Christian, right? So, like, I think by any measure, by a liberal reading of Christianity or a conservative reading of Christianity, it's hard to argue that Trump is a Christian. And so the Cyrus comparison has been used to say, well, look, sometimes God chooses unlikely leaders to save a nation at a critical point in its history. So in the Bible, King Cyrus was the Persian king who helped the exiled Jews return to Jerusalem and rebuild the holy city. The analogy there is that God has sent Trump to save America and rebuild a Christian America, even though he seems like an unlikely person for God to choose because he's not of the same religion as the people who are having their nation rebuilt. And so that's where the Cyrus thing came from.
Who developed that?
Like the coins and
where does that come from? Does that come spontaneously
I can't remember who the first person to say it was, but it became very popular in charismatic and Pentecostal circles. There's this evangelist, his name is Lance Wallnau. He's promoted it a lot. He's also promoted the wrecking ball theory that, you know, Trump is a wrecking ball. He's going to come and destroy everything because everything just needs to be ruined and like rebuilt. And so it became a very widespread meme. And to the extent that somebody's trying to make money off of it from the coins, which I actually haven't seen, that's not particularly surprising because that's kind of the Trump way, right? To like make money off of selling these trinkets, but selling trinkets is also very, very common in the prosperity gospel circles. Televangelists are always hawking, you know, trinkets and anointing oil and all sorts of things.
So lastly, what's happening with COVID? I mean, Trump is losing support. Is he losing any support in this community? And I imagine a lot of his loss of support is a function of his response to COVID. I think we're seeing that, you know, elderly people are like, you know what? I'm not on board with this. Right. I got to die for everybody else. Thing. What's happening in the evangelical community? Is something similar going on, or is it completely immune? I guess not to stretch the analogy from this.
So there's some polling that his approval ratings among white evangelicals have dipped into the 60s, which they have over the course of his first campaign and presidency. They've sort of fluctuated between like, you know, the mid 60s to the high 70s. The one poll to poll this question with white evangelicals, their approval of him during the COVID pandemic, to also ask the question, but hey, are you still going to vote for him in November, was Pew. And so they found that something like he only had like a 60-something percent approval rating among white evangelicals, but 82% of them said they were still going to vote for him nonetheless. So I think that's the really important question in that polling is, you know, okay, you might not be thrilled with the way he's handling the coronavirus, but, you know, you're going to vote for him nonetheless. And I think that in terms of the leadership, I think it's a combination of just kind of ignoring it and talking about other things, or just pretending that he's doing a fantastic job and it's just the fake news and the George Soros funded Black Lives Matter anarchists who are trying in the deep state who are trying to take him down.
Well, this is fascinating stuff, and I guess we'll find out. I mean, they're going to be there. I think they're sort of the archetype of I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, aren't they? In terms of his supporters,
mm-hmm. Yes, yes, many of them are.
Well, we will see. Sarah Posner, the book is Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. We will put a link to this at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. I'm going to head into the fun half. We've got a couple of breaking stories. One about the Umbrella Man. You remember that dude? He was the guy who was smashing the windows at the AutoZone, and he looked very, very suspicious in the way that he did it.
Yeah.
He has not been charged, but according to the Star Tribune, police are saying that Umbrella Man was a white supremacist trying to incite George Floyd rioting at the time, that he may be a member of the Hell's Angels biker gang. Don't hear that too often
anymore.
Yeah,
it's a throwback.
It's a little bit of a throwback. And that the suspect, apparently there was a tip via email that came into the cops. They have also connected the man. There have been no charges filed yet, which suggests to me that they don't quite have full proof yet, to an event in Stillwater, I guess that's in Minnesota, in which a Muslim woman was confronted by a group of men wearing white supremacist garb. Not sure what that means. Presumably maybe like white sheets or something to that effect. We will see if this is the guy. But I mean, he looked super suspicious, you know, when that happened. It did not seem, I mean, it was quite clear he wasn't of the protests. It seemed to me anyways.
Importantly, it seemed to the protesters themselves.
Yeah, they were all going like, dude, what are you doing? Why are you running off? They all thought he was a cop now. Who knows who knows, you know, but apparently they at least think that they know him as a suspect, and I guess there'll be more investigation into that. We also have, you know, I held off on this because there was a press release by Steny Hoyer this morning responding to the Republican proposal for the new stimulus bill. And it was good. I mean, it sounded like, to me anyways, let me get it right here. Where do I have this thing here? They came out with a statement that, do I not have it here? Oh yeah, here it is. Released the following statement today on the Senate Republicans COVID-19. This is Steny Hoyer. And remember, he's the House Majority Leader. He's not the Speaker of the House, but number two. Today, more than 2 months after the Democratic-led House passed the HEROES Act, and after weeks of internal division, Republicans have finally announced their own proposal with the clock ticking. Senate Republicans have had weeks to work with the House to craft an emergency aid package that extends these programs and helps public servants. Sadly, the package they introduced today fails to rise to the public health and economic challenges facing our nation. I'm deeply concerned the bill includes an unrelated White House demand for construction of new FBI quarters. Now that the Senate Republicans have at least announced, I urge them to move forward in negotiations immediately with the House to craft a final version that meets this moment and can be enacted into law without delay. Democrats remain ready. The American people demand action now to particular. And so it was, you know, they came out staking a position. But I didn't want to get too excited about it. And let's see, that statement was released, well, July 27th. So maybe last night, late, 12 hours later, CNN. Hoyer says Democrats aren't demanding $600 or bust. let me pre-negotiate our position away. So I want to make it absolutely clear. You've come in with $200 and we're at $600 and we're no longer at $600. So I mean,
I can't help but feeling that people like Steny Hoyer love to be in this position with Trump and the Republicans running things, and they can just easily fundraise off of it, but also, you know, be horrible in terms of like giving money to people.
I mean, it's just sort of, it's just, I don't understand what the theory is here.
I think it's pretty consistent. It's responsible government. You know, you can't have the FBI building because there's concerns about Trump's, you know, possible benefits from that construction. And at the same time, we're not going to, you know, shut down and keep government from functioning because of a couple hundred dollars for individuals.
It's absurd. It's absurd. And I just don't, they are just completely committed to this idea of we're going to do virtually nothing and just make this a referendum about Donald Trump. But the problem is that maybe they're counting on winning the Senate too, but again, you're still your baseline. Like even if the fact is that you can be a power craven individual and still see the benefit of giving people $600 a week. In fact, you should see a significant benefit to that. It's just, it's nuts. But do we have Nomi? Is she in the waiting room?
Yep, here she is.
Nomi and I will talk about this and the DNC platform. I know that Nomi's a little jaded when it comes to the platform, but we will talk more about that. Right?
Am I right? How do you know me so well, Sam?
You are. You don't play one too close to the vest, I got to tell you.
I was going to say, I've been keeping it inside. Maybe that's how jaded I am, is that what I have released is just like 10% of how jaded I am.
Exactly. I can only imagine. But all right, so we're going to take a break. I want to encourage you. Nomi, who's on your show this week?
Anna Kasparian.
Anna Kasparian,
on. A long tribute to Michael.
Okay, and people can check that out. Anna, of course, you've worked with Michael in a myriad of different ways. I know he did some work for you when you ran for office in the city. And Anna has been hosting a show with him for Jacobin on weekends. I think it's called Weekends.
Yep.
Folks can check that out. Also, check out The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada. James got a lot of things going on this week. Matt, tonight, I know you guys are doing a special TMBS tonight.
Yeah, we're having some live people stop by, and we have some video highlights of Michael and then some more messages. And so it'll be another sort of the final memorial show before we start getting back to work next week, keeping the show alive. So, yeah, check that out. TMBS YouTube channel tonight, folks.
Okay. That's youtube.com/TheMichaelBrooks Show. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And check out the AM Quickie. We're doing that every morning, give you a sense of what the news is for the day ahead. And all in about 6 or 7 minutes. We're getting it out very early in the morning now. So you get a sense of get up, have a cup of coffee, and in the time that takes you to finish that, you have a sense of what the day is going to look like in that regard. And of course, we also have merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Nomi's going to join me in the fun half. We'll be right back after this.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck you, reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? Hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.